Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Varca with Andy Lipson, and today we'll be discussing how has the service industry has been affected in the midst of COVID-19, or as most people call it, coronavirus, and how it has personally affected us as the host of What's Left. And as if our viewers are watching this, they can see that we are three-way on Skype, and this seems to be what life is like, this for at least for this past few weeks, for a lot of people who have been quarantined. And not just, well, we'll be discussing how the service industry has been affected, but our personal story really is in relationship to what is happening around this country, in the USA, what's happening in the States, and in the global community, really. There are a lot of people, I'm sure that both of you and our viewers and listeners who know people who are doing conference calls, working remotely, being affected by their jobs, facing massive layoffs, the economic recession looming, and as well as a lot of our young people being affected by the educational privatization of wanting to do online learning, which we'll discuss at a different time. But for now, all of this, what I'm mentioning, though, is just in the midst of this chaos. So let's bring it back home, though, and we'll be discussing it with specifically with our co-host, Kenny Cepeda. And we have here Andrew Lipson as well. I'm sorry, I didn't mention both of you. I'm not the only one doing this. So can you both say something, say hi, just for our listeners who are listening on this on podcast?
Well, I'm glad to be here with all of you, and I miss sitting on the same couch.
On our cozy couch.
Yes.
Kenny.
I don't know. No, I do. A lot of our freedom of movement has been reduced, for various reasons, and it's definitely affected life, personally, my work life, my relationships, and my community work. It's definitely changed things, and I'm curious to see where this is going to go, but I think right now we're trying to focus on what's happening, actually at the moment, and how we got here, maybe. But I don't know if you guys have any questions.
Well, you had said, I had said that I wanted this episode potentially to be about the coming wave of online education and what that means. And I do think we can talk about that later. But you've had a number of things just happen at your work in the last week. So Maybe start with that.
Well, yeah, we knew, you could see, so the volume, I work in the restaurant industry, in a restaurant. I am on the floor in the front of the house. I work as a manager and a server. So we are used to the fluctuations of the year of labor, after January, New Year's usually slows down a little bit. February is usually a very good month for everyone. But this obviously was unexpected. By March, we usually back into the swing of things in the restaurant industry. And I think just about, any bartender, any server, cook, any manager, any small business, big business, they know this ebbs and flows of the cycle, the business, or at least in the restaurant industry. And to a degree, also the hotel industry. Any service is really related to, tourism and, volumes of people increasing. So, yeah, last week, we've heard news. We knew that something was coming to the U.S.
Maybe before we start, can you say a little bit more about who works at your restaurant, the makeup there, kinds of folks that are there?
So my restaurant is a small one. It's like a mom and pop type of place. It's not a corporate, restaurant by any means. Very small staff. Maybe like on a given night, there's like seven people, including cooks, seven, maybe eight. cooks, prep person, bartender, busser, runner, two servers. So he's very small compared to other restaurants. You know, just like any restaurant in San Francisco, many of the kitchen staff, you know, they're from Latin America, you know, various countries. And that's really, you know, anywhere in San Francisco. And the front staff is usually people that obviously speak the language and also are more connected with the culture of the restaurant culture. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know if you have any other follow-up questions to that.
That's it.
Yeah. That's the general makeup. You know, we people from all walks of life, young people, as young, you know, some people are in college trying to, you know, pay through school. Other people are artists. So they work in the restaurant industry to be able to support art. You know, there's people with college degrees. They prefer to do this because it allows, at least when it's good, it allows a degree of freedom. You know, you're not working 9 to 5, and you have a little more flexibility in your life to pursue other things.
And how long has the place been there, and how long have you been working there?
I've been working there for about a decade. I was very young when I started. I left, I came back. Again, it's like a family. This place, I would honestly say it's like a family. A lot of people, the turnover is usually not very high. Most people end up working there at least 5 years. You know, we joke around that we're basically unionized, you know, because you really have to do something real dumb to get fired from this place, you know, and it's also a collective effort. It's not, for example, like tips are pooled. It's not like in other places where everyone's on their own and trying to, you know, basically competing with each other for volume or for competing, you know, for getting tables set. Here, everyone puts together, you know, everyone gets a little bit of the money. And, so I've been there about a decade. The place itself has been open for 14 years, which is an achievement in this city. Mm-hmm. In San Francisco, most places don't make it past 2-3 years, mm-hmm. Because it's basically big money that's taken over the market. And so, just to give you an idea, to open a place in San Francisco now, or at least until recently, just the liquor license is about $200,000 to $300,000, just the liquor license. And then you have other permits, you know, rent, payroll, stock up. And so you're talking about at least a couple $1 million to open a place now. So this place stands on its own. It's a success story. And it's being threatened by what's happening big time in like many other places.
I have a question, Kenny. There was a PBS NPR poll that was done that it was that nearly 1 in 5 households have already experienced a layoff or work reduction due to the pandemic. How much approximately are people getting paid? Are they getting paid at least minimum wage? Because there has been a fight for at least a $15 minimum wage nationwide for this country. So I'm just wondering if people are, you know, this is the service industry, if they are not able to pull through with even just the wages that they make already in the restaurants and their tips, and already facing the massive layoffs in the service industry in the midst of the coronavirus, are people at least getting paid the minimum wage here in San Francisco, which I think is 15, no?
Ahora, 15.69. It's 15.69 right. In San Francisco at the moment.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
So, I mean, just to give you an idea, San Francisco, I think, you can go and search your own, you know, and make sure that this is the right number, but roughly San Francisco has over 3,000 restaurants, you know, big sizes, small sizes. It's a pretty significant way people make a living in this area. It's not just San Francisco, because a lot of the workers that have gotten pushed out because of gentrification, high rents, they've been pushed out to the East Bay, so they commute to come and work here. You know, I know of places where workers come from Richmond, which, you know, for people that are not from the area, It's like a, 45-minute ride, you know, on the train, on the underground train. I mean, it's also like $8 to $10, yep. You know, in fare. But so they're willing to come here because there is, there used to be, at least until recently, a vibrant, you know, economy, and we are having protected by the tech industry. There's a lot of big money, a lot of, you know, young kids that want to go out, that have money, that come out of college, and the tech workers. And so, you know, the industry, like 2008, we were hit, but not as hard as other places in this nation. So the because I was working at this place actually in 2008. And yes, there was a, you know, obviously like a decreasing volume in, but it wasn't the existential threat that we're literally, experiencing right now. And, so when you're asking me about workers, you know, most people I would say in the restaurant industry, you know, they don't have a lot of savings, you know, you know, most people, as it is, the restaurant industry do not hire full time, because some restaurants don't want to pay the healthcare because it is a big burden. You know, it eats into their profits. And the truth is that a lot of small places in this city are not making a lot of money. No one's getting rich. You know, I can attest to my restaurant. No one's getting rich off my restaurant, even though the prices are relatively high. But that's just the conditions of this city. You know, and only the big businesses that are able to, you know, charge, you know, absurd amounts of money for a cocktail, $15, you know, and also they have economies of scale, you know, where you can produce, you know, mass produce, and then, you know, or bargain better prices, you know, wholesale from different, you know, providers. That's how you make money, but small restaurants are not. And so, we go back to, you know, again, the people, the individuals, the workers. Most workers are basically paycheck to paycheck. Most workers have a job and a half at least. One job is not enough, you know. And to be able to afford a $1,200, like to rent a room in San Francisco, is on average is $1,200 to live with other people.
Yeah, there is a housing crisis in San Francisco. Some people pay $3,000 for rents for a flat, or, you know, 1,200 minimum, I suppose, right? I mean, and we're talking about people who are being pushed out as well, no? Do any of your colleagues?
Most of my colleagues live in the city. They haven't been pushed out, but they do have a job and a half or two jobs. And, you know, just speak of their industry as a whole. That's this industry in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, in this nation, depends very much on the undocumented workers that are willing to work for just very close to the minimum wage. And they're the ones who have to have a job and a half or two jobs. And they are workers that are contributing, obviously paying taxes, but they're not going to see any unemployment benefits. Mm-hmm. You know, once right now that we are asked to be on quarantine and no restaurant is open, I mean, some restaurants are offering takeout food, but obviously that needs minimal staff. And in the case of my place, we're scrambling to keep people employed, you know, as much as we can. But truth is that it's not enough. And we have just started this. Again, last weekend, you asked this question earlier. Last weekend, before the quarantine was official, you know, we knew what was happening in Europe. Things were escalating. The volume of people the local government, the state government were giving, you know, like recommendations for gatherings. You know, so we started to see, you know, that number decrease, and we knew it was coming for us. You know, so big venues, you know, started concerts that I had to go to. You know, they canceled that I wanted to go. Sorry, but then we knew they ended up closing bars. And we knew what's coming for restaurants, and without volume, we're nothing, you know. And so the crunch started last weekend to us, not this last week, you know, not this Sunday past, but the one before that one. People were stopped, you know, the volume of people decreased maybe by 2/3, and we knew some tough times were coming. We didn't expect to be where we're now. We're basically, most of us are unemployed. Mm. there are social media, a lot of friends of the industry. I've noticed people started GoFundMe pages to support their staff at their, you know, their work. Because again, you know, we are all in a very precarious situation. I'll be okay. I can apply for unemployment, but not many other people can, you know, this industry.
Mm-hmm. You had said something about how some people were being laid off in order, some people who had, I guess, benefits first. Talk about that.
So, again, we are in an industry, there's people that work in unionized places. Again, a lot of people have two jobs. I know of people that, like, one of their main jobs was unionized, working for hotels. And that was a highly sought-after gig in San Francisco. You know, to be a cook at a hotel restaurant, you know, you can earn like $35, you know, and have very good benefits. That's not a, you know, that's decent. That's not greatest, but, you know, it's decent. And, you know, you would think that you have the protection of unions, right? And or that, you know, there's something to fall back on. But some of those workers in San Francisco were the first ones to be laid off or furloughed. How do you pronounce that?
Furloughed,
you know, because that's what we're all hearing, basically, the same story. We're going to basically fire you, and then we're going to rehire you, you know, once things get better. But the truth is that we don't know when better is going to be. Because, you know, even if the quarantine is lifted in 3 weeks, you know, there's going to be a lot of economic damage. Because we are not just workers, we're also consumers of this industry. You know, and so you can see how this vicious cycle can, like, become a snowball and, like, just grow. And we don't know how many restaurants are going to come out of this unscathed. You know, rents are pretty high for restaurants, too. You know, they are having to give away the stock that they have because you cannot hold on to food, you know, for 3 weeks.
Can you say specifically what's been the decision and impact at your restaurant?
So we're trying to do the to-go thing. Our bosses, again, they're you know, as much as they are capitalists, they're small capitalists. You know, they're nothing. They're closest to us. You know, and this is one of Marx's things, right? That they're closer to the proletariat than they're closer to, you know, to the big capitalists. Mm-hmm. So they're closer to the institution losing everything. In being unemployed in unemployment, then, you know, making it out of this. So they are trying to share, you know, the hours, spread the hours that we have, the work hours. But again, just doing to-go's doesn't require a lot of staff. And so they're scrambling to stay afloat because they care. And they, you know, they have what, in total, maybe like 15 lives, 15 families. They want to make sure, you know, continue to make a living and afford to be in this city. And so, you know, they took tough measures, you know. We decided to close one day. We've never done that. We were always open for 7 days a week. We decided to close one day, but then that quickly moved to, you know, obviously we were mandated to close, period. So then we have to scramble to find alternative ways to make a living. But then you're also subject to the big capitalists because in this city, there's also the ones that are raking it in right now are Grubhub, you know, Caviar. These are like big, you know, capitalist institutions that are squeezing small businesses before this happened. So now they're making a killing because they take a big chunk out of that of the delivery fees.
Right.
And so the people that are able to access these meals to be delivered are people that are better off. So I bet you most of the workers that have sustained this industry, most of the workers are not ordering in. And so it highlights this disparity, you know, that we have in the city.
And a lot of our workers that are working in the service industry don't get paid sick leave, no? So if they don't get paid sick leave during this pandemic, not everyone in this country, right, And if they don't get paid sick leave in this country, I feel as if they're, if we're trying to supposedly halt or stop or pause from being the country being so-called contaminated through this coronavirus pandemic, then what we need to do is have a good look at the way that this system is working and seeing that it's not working for all of us, because it's, if we don't take care of our workers, right, because it goes in a tall order, we get rid of people, right? I feel as if the workers in this case, with the personal experience that you're sharing, then it affects the rest of us, because we have to get food from people, right? Like at McDonald's, at Wendy's, at Jack in the Box, so people who are working there. And if they don't get paid sick leave or they're not getting the right healthcare system, then we're affected as well. I think that we are to experience even more greater sicknesses, diseases, and viruses in the future. And this is sort of like a window into the future of what it would look like and how capitalism is not working and how it could potentially really screw us up in the future if we're not careful, given what we are facing right now. Our workers are the ones on the front lines. And imagine if there was a greater pandemic, greater one than this one, and they have to forcefully go to work because they don't have paid sick leave, then they're spreading all of those viruses and diseases to the rest of us. And I'm just calling out how our frontline workers, that includes the service industry, don't have the benefits of paid sick leave, don't have the benefits of a good healthcare system, don't have the benefits of a savings account with money extra for cushion, don't have the benefits, you know, because we live in, as the three of us, at least I consider myself to be anti-capitalist and you two as socialists, but we don't live in a, we live in a capitalist system. That's what I'm pointing out to. I'm just away just from everything you're talking about. I just feel that that is what I'm present to.
I mean, I mean, it's highlighting the pillars of capitalism. Like, think about private property, for example. A lot of us that are early employed or unemployed, we are deeply worried about paying rent, making rents, and in turn, even like the landlords, you know, they're also, you know, if they're not getting rent from some people, they can't make their mortgages. And so, and it goes up, you know, businesses can make rents, you know, and people can make payments on their houses. And so, you know, houses is a fundamental human right. And even that we don't have. You know, one, I even before this crisis started, I viewed a lot of us workers in this area, at least in San Francisco, Bay Area, as landless peasants. We are landless peasants. And it is it fully exposed right now. Yeah. Most of us don't own property, you know. And so, you know, what's going to happen if most of us can't afford rent? Mm-hmm. How are we going to organize, you know, and say, fuck this, you're not going to kick me out. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that, you know, we are not ready for that in some ways, but sorry.
What has been the response by your coworkers to what's happened? How have they dealt with this or tried to deal with it?
It almost feels like a lot of people are dazed and confused, you know, to quote Led Zeppelin. It's so soon. This moves so fast. Like, if you think about it, so Sunday we had a normal shift, if you call it. We had service, we had people. By Monday, they said, we can't open anymore. By Tuesday, they were like, you cannot open anymore. All you can do is to go through.
Right.
So this is very recent. The dominoes just started falling. The chips are just, you know, we don't know how far it's going to go. And as it is already, you know, to maybe connect it to my work in that community, we've been scrambling to secure food for so many people right now. Because, again, just a few days of not working, you know, have started a mass need for food, for meals. You know, and we're talking about 3 weeks of networking.
Yeah.
You know, and this is just the first few days. We right. haven't been, it hasn't been a week. So everyone's out of answers, you know, and at least if you were to look at the bigger picture, a lot of people are without answers. You know, some people have funds to last maybe a week, two,
right.
you know, maybe a month. But if this is going to go beyond a month, you know, the financial aspect, even if the sanctions are uplifted, this is going to take some time for people to recuperate.
Right.
You know, so, you know, I think people are just scrambling, you know, trying to see if somehow they can find work in another place. But this is en masse. This is everyone in the industry affected. You know, I don't think most people could see this coming ever
yeah.
in their life.
And that's why I guess there's been this talk in the federal government. Trump has talked about essentially the universal basic income kind of approach, where there's talk of sending yeah. everyone, well, sending all people who are citizens, all adults who are citizens, $1,000, and then maybe $500 per kid. But as you said, there's definitely a set of undocumented workers who are working and have been doing work in places who that's not going to help them survive.
Yeah, I mean, there are 10 to 12 million undocumented people in this nation. I mean, maybe not everyone's in the labor force, but that's a decent amount of people. And this is going to affect, again, construction, the restaurant industry, you know, just all the service industries, you know. So, yeah, I mean, the impact is pretty big, and it is exponential, I think. You know, it's, yeah, and we can't measure it now. It's just like any crisis in capitalism, you know, you can't see it until in retrospective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may be able to, you know, shit is coming, but we don't know how bad it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, even, like, I saw the unemployment applications, you know, like, they had, like, 200,000 in a matter of a few days or something like that. And again, this is, like, the first few days of people not being employed.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's also only the people that can apply to.
Right.
So if 200,000 people, you know, maybe add another third of people that can apply for, you know, so that's what, you know, almost 300,000 people, I don't know, without a job in the first few days.
Right.
And this is going to fall, you know, it's going to pull all the industries down.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's been both a supply issue going on, but then a demand issue, where the demand for services has been just brought down by, what, 70%, 80% by virtue of people not being able to move and not being allowed to congregate.
Yeah. And, I mean, that also speaks to us becoming a service nation, right, and not like a, you know, kind of outsourcing and bringing production to other nations.
Hmm.
And that, I'm not making a nationalist argument. It's just a fact, right? Like, you know, we've socialized the methods of production for the world. Mm. And it's, you know, it's the virus has come to expose the fundamentals of this nation and, you know, how labor is, you know, pretty fucked.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I read a book that talked about how actually, the level of manufacturing in the United States has stayed relatively, it stayed relatively high, but what's happened is the number of workers who do that job has been diminished.
Yeah.
As you've had increased efficiency and technology and robots and things like that. So actually, it's still a country that is a manufacturing center. Obviously, China has been competing with the United States and then Europe and other places. But no doubt that the number of jobs in just that manufacturing sector has gone down and down and down, even though the productivity of an individual worker has actually increased. Those are some of the things I've read about.
And just to jump off that, I think that's another aspect that I think about the industry that, okay, people, you know, some people assume that, okay, the quarantine is lifted, we go back to normal production. And what always happens in any crisis is that the, you know, the economy or economic adjustments, whatever, the worker ends up doing more work, you know, for the same pay, basically. And so they're not going to rehire everyone, you know, as much as benevolent as they want to be. If they want to survive in even a small business, they cannot rehire everyone right away. You know, and they are going to demand more from each worker, you know, to survive. And then that the incentive for them is not to just flush the system with workers. Yeah. It's not. So it's going to adjust to, again, be more efficient. Mm-hmm. And that means more work for less workers.
Yeah. Well.
And so that means less jobs for people.
Yeah, I mean, officially, we're not in recession. That's the word that's being bandied about now, global recession. Supposedly, you need 2 quarters of negative growth and things like that. But I think we can see that there's something going on that is very similar to 2008 when the last recession hit. And, you know, that's what a recession is basically production cannot continue as normal. So there has to be a mass either set of layoffs, a mass restructuring the economy to bring profits back. And people knew there was a correction coming, and now I think the pandemic has kind of tipped the global economy to the point where it's screaming, and it looks like again workers are going to pay the price unless we do something.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know. It just to me keeps showing again that the savagery of this system, you know, and how it can never prioritize life. That's why I'm not a reformist. You know, the simple fact, you know, of, you know, again, in San Francisco, many people can't afford rent. If they lose their job, they won't have health care. A lot of the workers. So when you need it the most, you can't have it. You know, health care, for example. And it's just finding it incapable. Again, so long as production is entangled with profit, you know, we can never prioritize life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, we've talked about it, why I'm a socialist revolutionary, and this is one of the reasons, because I just don't see how, you know, for example, Spain, like the Spanish government just nationalized the hospitals, understanding the massive crisis that is coming, because, you know, hospitals are, you know, under capitalism, they're in the business of making money, you know, and we see it in America, in the U.S., how expensive healthcare is here. Ridiculously expensive. And I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the families as well that have been affected by this. I'm sure many families. I used to work at an elementary school, and so many of our families were part of the service industry, whether that be housekeepers, or they were sometimes construction workers, or they were restaurant workers, or if they also, you know, they just belong part of that industry. And any time we had a furlough, Andy, do you remember those furloughs we used to have?
Yep.
Any time we had those furloughs, parents would come to our school and they would say, "I don't know where to place my kid. I have to go to work." They already had set the times or the days they could miss for Labor Day or other holidays that were already listed on that SFUSD calendar. SFUSD is the San Francisco Unified School District, or any academic calendar, right? But they hadn't foreseen the furlough days. And furlough days, if Andy, you can just quickly say, what's a furlough day?
It was just a way for people to say, you're not going to get paid. We need to reduce costs by not having you work as long a school year. So you lost pay, but you didn't work as long a year. It's sort of like, and it's a temporary measure, just like what Kenny's describing. His colleagues are experiencing a kind of a furlough for a few weeks, if you will.
And you go, and you don't go into work.
Yeah, you're not. You don't work.
And for those of us educators that would have those furlough days, that meant children would not go to school. And if children didn't go to school, a lot of our families could not afford a child care provider or, you know, a babysitter. They had to take their kids to work, or they had other socio-emotional issues where they couldn't, you know, deal with their child all day long. Or their living situation, if they're, you know, if you have a house, a flat where you're living with 2-3 other families and they have kids as well, I mean, you're just right there crowded. And I can only imagine what's going on, that you're not supposed to be going out during this time. Well, at least not in public with other people, right? And we live in a city, an urban setting, the kids that are being cooped up today. And so I'm just thinking about the families that many of your colleagues have, or even out, not just in your restaurant, but other restaurants as well, where people who are working in the service industry, where they have to be at home with their kids because, or take care of their kids, or figure out what to do with their kids because they don't have the means to like a wealthy person to provide entertainment, academics, whatever it is that you need.
Yeah.
I'm here supporting my brother with my nephew. He's lucky he has me, but I mean, you know, all day, it's a challenge being with a child. So I can only imagine what it's like for the rest of the families.
And I mean, some of these people also depend like on at least one of their kids' meal, you know, being provided at school. Like today, I just, before we recorded this, I came back from like passing out food, you know, that one of my friends was able to secure, you know, like donations. And we were able to bring, you know, a bag of, you know, food for, you know, like 20 families. But that's just, you know, a tiny, you know, number when you think about the whole district, right? Like in the Bay Area and this nation. You know, there is so many people, you know, in trouble. Like, food security is a big issue.
Yeah.
You know, and, yeah.
Although here in San Francisco, there are free food, for free meals at certain sites. But that still does not cover, you know, how many meals a day you have, right? There are meals. I'm not sure if they just provide breakfast and lunch.
Yeah.
But if we look about the nation, not everyone is doing that. And all of our counties here in the greater Bay Area.
And,
so,
But it's also about, you know, access to information, that everyone knows this. It's also about pride, because that's one of the myths about, you know, especially the Latino community, that, you know, some people like to perpetuate, that we depend on fucking, you know, the welfare system. And a lot of people are fucking proud. You know, and they don't want to ask for help. You know, and they want to try to figure it out before they, you know, they go to the last resort. Now, a lot of people that are receiving this food, they're asking me, is it from the government? Like, I don't want help from the government. You know, because some people may be residents, and, you know, this administration, you know, threatened to, you know, make it difficult for people to pursue a path to citizenship if you received, you know, help from the government. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, so yeah, there is this food in San Francisco, but the number, the crisis that we're facing, there is not enough food, because, the way that depends on a lot of, you know, benevolence, and the scale that we're talking about, we are starting something big, you know, and I don't think those systems are going to be able to survive. You know, and for long, without something drastic changing. Because, you know, as it is, a lot of homeless people don't get a bed in this city. You know, they don't always get a meal. You know, and so add more people basically facing that, you know, near destitution. You know, so there will be a big, you know, overload of the whatever little welfare system there is, you know, and it's mostly community organizations, not the government. There's a lot of churches, a lot of community people, you know. So yeah.
So what do you think should be or should have been the response? Because obviously the mayor of this city and all these counties basically declared quarantine. But didn't really have
a plan. Which was the strictest of all the nation. This was the most strictest shelter in place. This area was the most strictest in all of the nation.
Yeah. What do you feel like should have been done in response to this?
I mean, if they understood or cared at least about, they cared about, they understood the condition of the working people in this city, and the potential mess that this was going to create, it should have frozen rents or costs,
right.
You know, bills, you know, everything.
Yep.
You know, because, and they may have to still, just to save capitalism, literally, because otherwise people are going to say, fuck it. You know, because where are you going to get money if you're not working? You know, and are you going to evict everyone, especially during a crisis that, you know, has the potential of being very deadly?
Yeah, I do you think know, that. So they, yeah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Sorry.
I mean, some countries, I know the country where I was born, the president, who's a fucking asshole too, he just like declared that, like, a freeze on bills. No one's going to pay for electricity, water, you know, a bunch of shit.
Yeah.
And we're still mulling that shit. We're going to send $1,000 so people can, you know, that doesn't begin to cover, you know, the need of people.
No.
And they already have another check in the works, and they're going to have to dump a bunch of money. And, you know, any economist will tell you that they're also kicking a can down the road, the can of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and within these models, you know, and that has the potential of just collapsing economies. It's been artificially created in countries like Venezuela, you know, and enemies of the USA. You know, they're used to, you know, to say how socialism is really bad and shit. But we are facing that here, and we might face that very soon. You know, and so, again, when inflation takes root, people don't give a shit about, they won't give a shit about the dollar. Maybe I'm being an alarmist, whatever. But it's a possibility.
No,
you know, alternative means of exchange.
Yeah, there's this story, and this was stories prior to World War One of people, I think it was prior to World War One of people in Germany carrying around whatever their currency in wheelbarrows because it had been devalued, and I think that is a concern. I mean, they've just pumped what I've heard anywhere from $2.2 trillion to $5 trillion with the plans of that into the stock market and into the economy. I don't think they really know where all this leads.
Yeah. No, they're just focusing on the immediate, and that's kind of what happened in 2008. You know, I remember Bush in 2001 when they started giving people some money, but this isn't mass because the supply chains are disrupted,
mm-hmm.
You know, and so it has the potential of evolving, you know, and they're going to try to address that later. But again, this is another Marxist, that, you know, capitalism, by saving itself, creates worse conditions for the next crisis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, they basically ran out of room at the Fed to decrease the interest rates before this shit happened.
Yeah.
And so now they're basically about to give away money for free, pay to banks. That's the next step. Pay banks to receive the money.
Right.
Because after zero, there's negative, so then the federal government, you know, has to pay. You know, and if any government that has had issues with inflation knows that by printing money, which is basically what they're literally doing, you know, you increase in inflation.
Yeah. Well, I think the goal or the hope, I think, in each of these countries, because one of the things that I've been reading about comparing the economic crisis in 2008 to this one, is how in 2008 a lot of the countries came together to try to figure out how we're going to, which banks are going to be shut down, how are we going to bail each other out. But in this time, it's everyone for themselves. And United States, China, even within Europe, all that is supposedly united around European Union, each of these countries in the response to the crisis is trying to figure out its own plan. And again, this is part of what the rising nationalism and the kind of situation where you're going to try to figure out, how do I make my opponent pay for this crisis more than myself so that I defeat them? And the U.S. has really started gearing that up with language about, you know, trying to become self-sufficient. What was the recent act they passed? I can't remember what it was called.
The military, like the wartime act or something?
Yes. Let me get the exact name of it. Hold on. The Defense Production Act.
Yeah.
Which is really, ostensibly it's about the U.S. becoming self-sufficient and developing medical equipment, things like that, but it's also microchips and electronics, and it's really about saying we are going to make sure, the government is going to make sure that the United States is the producer of these things, and we're not just going to let corporations do whatever. They're not going to go wherever they want. And it's about, it's really about the kind of state capitalism that we started to see prior to World War II, where the governments and the corporations become kind of fused interests, and the governments try to essentially run capitalism within their country, so it's best fit to compete with the other countries. And again, these are the pressures that are leading towards this economic crisis, which people expected, but apparently it took this pandemic to kind of kickstart it, has sort of exposed these sorts of fractures that are going up between nations. And it's very dangerous. It's the pressures towards World War III, and we're already looking like we're entering conditions that are similar to like a new Cold War with China.
Yeah, I mean, and I think maybe this sounds arrogant, but a lot of people naively think that this will end in like a, you know, more united world. But when our governments are capitalist governments, you know, like you said, you know, it actually very likely to tiny degree of like right wing nationalists, you know, the strong man winning, you know, and leading the, you know, people through crisis.
Yeah.
You know, and especially when we're not organized, right, to be able to take over, you know, the supply chains and means of production, you know, to be able to sustain life.
Yeah.
The most basic, you know, fundamental thing. Then, like, you know, we talked about it, I think, a little bit. It's everyone for themselves, you know. Then the guns do become dangerous against, you know, one another.
Yeah.
You know, they're not gonna, because they're not being pointed at our capitalist government.
Yeah. And hidden within this experience, though, is the notion that if workers, like what amount of power workers could wield in shutting the entire system down if they can do it on their own terms. I think there is that element within this experience. Of course, this is not how it's this is not worker organized, you know. This is state organized. But hidden within this is how much power the working class has to make everything offline. And then they can choose what goes up and what goes down. So there is a lesson to be learned, but it's we're a long way away from that. And just to say, we've been talking about France and the yellow vests. I read an article about this that there actually still are yellow vest protests, but they're very small. And those protests were deemed illegal in the context of the coronavirus, and they went ahead and had a protest of a few hundred people. That takes a lot of courage, a lot of clarity to still go forward with that. But you can see the impact that this stuff has had globally on just only a month ago or so, me and Eduardo, and maybe even you, Kenny, we were having episodes about, you know, the global movements that were taking over. And this is a stake in the heart against them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you want to jump in, but...
Well, I'm just going to say that people have been fined recently. I was talking to my friends there, and they've been telling me that now the police are out on the streets of Madrid, really making sure that they're not supposed to leave. It's not optional. And then, what was it, two nights ago? Two nights ago, I was looking at Macron. He was ordering as well the same thing. He said young people are not paying attention. So first it was Italy, then it's Spain, and now it's France. So the government is going after people who are not obeying the orders, imposed orders, such as curfew hours and certain activities. And even Belgium is doing the same, and they're not being allowed unless they have a specific paper that has access. It just sort of felt a little bit Orwellian to me, the entire thing. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, you know, because we were talking, the three of us, that I might just go, before they decided to close the border, I said I would go to France. And then after I heard of all this, I don't think I want to be in a situation like that where I don't have access to even leave, to go out on the corner just without having a permit.
Yeah.
Man.
It's very Orwellian.
I mean, I definitely think that, I mean, obviously, we lack perspective, you know, from this. We're still in it. But we are maybe living in an era of the reaffirmation of the state over people. Yeah. Because, you know, in some degree, people, yeah, there wasn't rest. It wasn't organized, you know, to be able to really challenge the you know, powers that be. But like you said, you know, a lot of places in Latin America, which is where I pay attention to, you know, at least 8-10 countries were uprising against the government, or there was unrest. And so, again, this is, the governments are not going to let go of the, you know, opportunity of reasserting themselves under populations, under the guise of protecting her, even though they themselves have left us vulnerable.
Yep.
You know, and I think that just connected to here, San Francisco, and I hope, again, I don't know if that will be the route that this will take. I hope that the lesson that we get out of this is that we are on our own. You know, like workers, these fuckers left us unprotected, you know, and we are pulling out. We are going to have to pull out of this together, collective, you know. And, you know, I've seen some people starting to organize some funds and stuff. Obviously, that's far from, you know, what we need. But I hope that we learn the lesson that we are on our own and that we need to organize in mass, you know. And so we can ourselves protect ourselves from future shit like this.
And a key part of that unity is going to be workers who are citizens building solidarity with workers who are not.
Yeah.
If we are not able to do that, then we're not going to be able to do this. And there are some ideas I have for things that are ways we can do that in this next few weeks. So we'll see.
Yeah.
But I don't want to talk about them until there's other things that happen.
All right. Well, I'll just add Leslie on what we're talking about as well. It's not just the curfews and the imposed regulations. It's as well as the massive surveillance that will now happen because most people are working remotely and have to go to a specific apps. Zoom, we're on one right now, Skype.
Yeah.
And then the future of online learning, which we won't discuss in detail now, but I'm just touching a little bit on it just to say that it's not just about the educational system that will change as well as the workforce. And this will all be in the hands of corporations that will obviously be as well in cahoots with the government to have massive surveillance on the rest of us. Just before this call, there were other people today in this household that were on conference calls, checking in with their friends. And I have another friend that was as well doing a Netflix friend watching, where they can watch the same film together as a family or as friends together, something like that. I'm not sure of the details, but it's now streaming line services that now have this access to conference or video call, video chat ways of connecting to one another. And I think that technology has been a great force, but it also is going to be our, what's the opposite of great force? Andy, you know the expression, a great force, or could be our defeat, I think it is.
Yeah, well, but it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyhow, the point is that it's not just, I was just trying to say, it's not just about not being able to go out on the streets. It's also about fear-mongering. I think I have been the one out of the three of us that have been very cautious not to undermine the way that the pandemic has been in the media. But I think in this episode, I'm feeling that from everything I'm listening to, that the government really is using this as an excuse. I think it's important to be cautious, as I have sort of was arguing with you both the last two times. But in this episode, I'm feeling that it is very much like the government's way of excusing itself for why it's doing certain things. Mm-hmm. I see it's more and more the creeping, the slight cheeky ways of getting into our lives with every means necessary through permits and surveillance and more cameras and more apps and more. It's just the surveillance state is growing. And so I'm just feeling like, how do we counter that with the importance of being hygienic and the importance of also communicating the necessity for us to be to take care of ourselves? We need to have that information, but we don't need it to be diluted, as I also said last time, with not just conspiracies, as I already, I'm not going to talk about this time, but diluted with supposedly more nanny watching from the government.
Yeah.
That, I feel, is being diluted in there as well. The government is slowly and just persuading people, no, to accept. We're doing this for your own good.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
And that, it's like, that was right there watching us. You know? It's like,
I mean, so that was the argument I think Lipson and I, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, we're making about the media. That's a function to tell you that, you know, fear is that part of that function, right? Like, to scare you to the point that, you know, we need the government. That we need to believe that lie. You know, like, especially these capitalist assholes who have put us in a vulnerable situation. Again, people that, you know, don't have housing, you know, or are being threatened. Obviously, you're going to want to keep working as much as you can. But otherwise, you probably go home, you know, all right, at the first sign of being sick. You know, and again, putting people in vulnerable situations is not just the coronavirus. You know, the simple flu could kill a lot of people. You know, a lot of vulnerable people that we're trying to protect right now, worldwide. But this shouldn't be just because of the coronavirus, you know, the security and the people's livelihoods, you know, dignity and just the basic things, you know, food, you know, a roof on your head and all the healthcare, you know. But obviously, it's all for sale. So,
yeah.
Well, I couldn't have said it better than the both of y'all said it. So, I mean, I very much agree with what you're saying, Eduardo, about the perniciousness of the surveillance state. I almost feel like they're not moving slowly. Actually, they feel like they're moving rapidly. But I really agree and.
Well, I meant in the underlying messages, yeah, I suppose, yeah. Maybe, yeah, they are.
Yeah, yeah. But no, I really agree with what you said. So I would guess I would just say to people, wash your hands and then go read Communist Manifesto.
Yeah. on a more personal note, how are you to holding up on your time, mate, being quarantined?
Me, on my end?
Yeah.
Brandy's getting sick of me. She's tired of me.
Brandy, for our viewers and listeners, is Andy's partner.
she's like, when are you going to leave? When is the quarantine going to be up to get you out?
And Kenny, what are you doing? You were saying you were delivering food, Kenny.
Yeah, I mean, taking as much precautions, you know, because actually a lot of the people that I've been delivering to are some of the most vulnerable people over 60. Like, you know, a lot of my mother's coworkers, you know, who are in a unionized hotel with a fucking union that never, you know, fought when they had to, you know, like, so they're basically unemployed, and, you know, most of them are elders, and so, you know, yeah, I had to procure food for them, and obviously taking precautions, you know, like, not, because I don't want to be, you know, the cause of their, you know, demise, but, you know, someone's got to do this shit, because no one else coming, you know, the fucking government ain't coming.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, so yeah, they're talking in public about, you know, fucking, you know, saving them, protecting them, but in reality, they're letting them to starve, leaving them to starve, you know, and like they've always had, you know, like we know that in, you know, poverty among like elders is very high in this nation compared to any other industrialized nation. You know, so yeah, that's what I've been doing. And again, trying to be cautious. I have a mother. She's 64. She's pretty healthy, but again, I don't want to be the reason, you know, that, you know, she gets sick and, you know, this shit, you know, happens. You know, so yeah, been doing deliveries, but I put shit on the ground and remind them to wash everything that I give them, wash their hands before they put anything in their mouth. I don't get near them. You know, some of them have health conditions. Mm-hmm. But again, these fuckers ain't knocking at the door with food for them.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Eduardo?
Well, I'm cooking all day, so I'm spending time cooking. We don't go out for takeout or home or rather, I just don't do takeout food normally. But I have more time to cook greater meals and not just fast meals that sort of are bland. So I have time to cook for that, as well as I'm catching up on my writing. And I'm really behind, but now I'm able to catch up on my writing and studying as well. So and helping out with my nephew, which is I hope that yeah.
Oh, I'm disgusted by privileged people.
Look at us. We're lazing around. Kenny's out there doing a good deed.
All right. So why don't we wrap up? Yeah, let's just say goodbye. All right. So for any of our listeners and viewers, they can check us out on any of our 5 platforms on BitChute, Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes Podcasts, or YouTube. Subscribe, rate, review, and best of all, share with your family and community. Thank you, Andy, and thank you, Kenny. And thank you, Kenny, for what you're doing out there. And keep us up to date what's happening with you. All right. So this will end the call. All
right.
All right, guys.
See you guys.
Ciao.
This is what's left, Eduardo. A weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left.
What's the don't ever say my line ever in your life again.
Oh my god!
I copyrighted that.
I know.
It's patent.
All right. So whenever you're ready.